It's all the files of the whole park. It tells you everything.
Sir, he's uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
It's one of my favorite cyber topics in the books. The cyber arms race and the increasing weaponization of the internet and how that plays into the world of geopolitics. Of course, that means spies, hackers, dealers, and journalists alike. That's why today we have New York Times cybersecurity reporter Nicole Perlroth to talk about her new book, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends. I'm Ben Makku, and this is Cyber, and it's still being recorded from my apartment in New York. So, Nicole, thanks for coming on Cyber. You were on Cyber War a little while ago. That's many moons ago.
I know. So many moons ago. What I remember the most from that is that we taped it and then the van got broken into in San Francisco, which is more normal than not, and all the film equipment got stolen.
And we had to do it again. Right. We got cased and our entire crew, all of our stuff was stolen, including like laptops, everything. It was crazy. But that was in
case. Okay, so probably some hackers.
That was in 2000.
They didn't want it to come out.
And that was 2015. And you've been reporting on cybersecurity with the New York Times since about 2011, right?
That's right. Yep.
That's been a long
10 years.
10 years. That's been a long time. And, you know, myself and some of the people at Motherboard, we've been reporting on this for a really long time too. And, you know, the idea of cyber warfare and hacking vis-a-vis geopolitics has come a long way since 2011. And I was just sort of interested, as someone who just wrote a book on the cyber arms race, how do you think since 2011, like how much has this changed for you reporting on it?
It's been crazy. You know, I know it's been 10 years, but I still feel very green because every attack that comes along, you know, even if you're really well versed in the last attack, you're just parachuting into this new situation you know nothing about. And so every time these attacks happen, I feel like I have imposter syndrome because, you know, it's something totally new. But back in 2011, when I started, I mean, the big story back then was Anonymous.
We are Anonymous. We are Legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Expect us.
Which seems so quaint these days. You know, Anonymous was like DDoSing people, anyone who was going to fall over. You know, that's what I was covering day to day. And then there was this, you know, bigger thing happening where people talked a lot about Chinese cyber espionage and intellectual property theft, which we talked about for your cyber warfare show. And I think when I got in here, I mean, the first big thing that happened was the Times got hacked by China. So I got a front row seat to that attack. And that really took up the whole year. And then there was this other thing where people were sort of warning me constantly about what they called a cyber Pearl Harbor, cyber 9/11. And I remember back then asking these officials like Richard Clark, okay, so, you know, you're predicting the cyber Pearl Harbor, like how long is that going to be? And without fail, they always said the same thing, which was 18 to 24 months. We'll see an attack like this in 18 to 24 months. And we never saw that attack. I mean, we saw bits and pieces of it. We saw Russia, you know, turn off the power in Ukraine a couple times. We saw the Iranian attacks on Saudi Aramco and Sands Casino, and then the ransomwaring of all these hospitals. But we still haven't seen the big one. But it does seem like every new attack that happens, we just get a little bit closer. And right now, during the pandemic, I just feel like everything is happening all at once. And it's really hard to keep track.
And you know, it's interesting because we've covered at Motherboard something like SolarWinds. And now, you know, SolarWinds is this big question mark. And what's the damage done by these alleged Russian hackers, mm-hmm. et cetera? You know, it wasn't too long ago that it was OPM in the Office of Personnel Management. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese had completely stolen this personal data. But, you know, all of these, the one thing all of these have in common is it isn't a cyber Pearl Harbor. So it kind of begs the question,
right.
Is that even possible? And do you think it's some over-posturing from the government that this is happening? I remember when Leon Panetta said that, and it was such a buzzword for so long.
The collective result of these kinds of attacks could be a cyber Pearl Harbor.
an attack that would cause physical destruction and the loss of life.
And, you know, he got really dismissed, you know, because people were saying that he was stoking FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt to scare everyone. And, you know, I look at, back at those warnings differently, which was I was happy someone was sounding the alarm. I don't think people understood the threat very well. I don't think they understood the repercussions of hooking up our water treatment plants and everything else to the internet and baking vulnerable software into these systems or not running their software updates. So I was glad he was sort of sounding it off, but you're right. We haven't seen that attack yet, but we've come so close. I mean, SolarWinds, it's like they got in, no one detected it until FireEye got hacked 9 months later. And we're told, oh, well, it's a, you know, it was a close call because it was espionage. But we also know that Russia used that same pattern and access in Ukraine to pull off the NotPetya attack for sabotage. You know, we know like a couple of years ago, we got that famous DHS screenshot of Russia's hackers with basically their hands on the controls at a power plant. And then, you know, we know how easy it is for that destruction to happen either with a wiper malware or with ransomware. So we keep just getting like a little bit closer. And, you know, there was that attack that the Iranian hackers pulled off at the wrong Bowman Dam, you know, when they got into the controls at the dam that held back this little creek in New York versus the real crazy large Bowman Dam in Oregon that could have caused serious damage if they'd actually mucked around with the controls. So, you know, we know that the capabilities are there. It just seems like we're all waiting for some kind of geopolitical, you know, kinetic, physical war to happen before we start seeing the cyber elements come into play. And I think that's what people call hybrid warfare. And we're just not there yet. But I don't think that means we need to just wait for that to happen. I feel like now with SolarWinds, we really have this pretty visceral threat hanging over us where the government can't even trust its own, communication channels. And it'll be a long time before we uncover every last Russian backdoor. So why not use this as an opportunity to basically, you know, rip out the systems we don't need, do inventory on our software, understand where it's made, and really pressure software vendors to take secure coding seriously. It just seems like now is that good time.
But I think you're completely right. I mean, that's the thing is that, and you hear it, I'm sure you've heard it a lot of times. I've heard it quite a few times. The idea that, you know, the Chinese hacking agencies, the Russian hacking outfits, and the NSA themselves are kind of all in each other's systems with their fingers on the proverbial trigger, that if anything did happen, that this could happen. So I guess the question is, you know, and it's something that I think you raise in the book, in that this keeps happening. I mean, in a really uncertain political climate, both domestically and geopolitically, how much more likely do these sorts of attacks and these sorts of kinetic cyber attacks, how much more likely do you think from your viewpoint, how much more possible is it?
I mean, I think it's very possible. I mean, the big thing was, you know, my book comes out today and I talk at times in the book about what the threat would be to, say, a water treatment facility. And then fortuitously yesterday, you know, the small town in Florida, Oldsmar, Florida, population 15,000, announced that on Friday, a hacker got into the controls at the water treatment plant and upped the amount of LYE in their systems from like 100 parts per million to 11,000 parts per million. I mean, that's very real. And it just so happened that there happened to be this guy sitting in front of his computer watching his cursor move around. And 5 hours later, saw that same cursor go into these functions and mess with the chemical controls. So that's happening. But, you know, I would not be surprised if that ends up being some, you know, domestic terrorist, basically. I know we feel uncomfortable using the word terrorism with some of these digital attacks, but, you know, we're getting closer and closer. Like when there was this ransomware attack at a Vermont hospital I covered 2 months ago. You know, we talk about, well, thank God, you know, it's not like it affected treatments. You know, doctors could still see patients. Yeah, it caused some hiccups, but no big deal. We can get through this. But what I learned covering that attack was that chemo patients weren't able to get their chemo treatments because their chemo protocols had been completely wiped out. Like, suddenly these threats are becoming, that were so invisible for so long, are becoming very visible. And it almost seems like every week something happens that ups the last one. And so we're just sort of in this escalating spiral to the bottom. And the question is, like, at what point do we say, whoa, 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 you know, we need to get ahead of this. And, you know, I mean, I started 10 years ago, like I looked very skeptically on those people who said 18 to 24 months, but now I'm even saying 18 to 24 months. So, you know, I don't know when we're going to have that big attack. I just hope we can head it off before it happens.
But this is the thing, is like, when you look back on, you know, to return to 2011, it really was the big games in town that could actually pull off these big, big hacks would be, mm-hmm. you know, the U.S., China, Israel, Russia, or UK, probably Five Eyes. We'd probably include all of them. Mm-hmm. But now, I mean, the capabilities of sort of the middle powers and the different types of countries that previously had no real cyber outfit to speak of have them, and they're getting better. And it's not necessarily, you know, that you need NSA powers to knock out a dam in Nevada. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. The skills gap, I would say, has sufficiently closed. You know, anyone, if they don't have like trained skills hackers on staff to pull off these attacks, they can certainly buy their way into some of these capabilities. Maybe not to take out a dam, you know, undo the locks at the dam specifically, but, you know, certainly to pull off a wiper attack on a major U.S. multinational corporation, like we saw with NotPetya hitting FedEx and Pfizer and Merck and wiping out their vaccine supply. I mean, can you imagine right now mm-hmm. if something like that yeah. happened?
Something
that's,
simple.
That's a very something simple. Yeah. And I think that's what we learned is for so long, Five Eyes and particularly the United States thought that, okay, as long as we maintain our offensive advantage, you know, we can continue to outsmart the enemy. And unanimously, when I talk to officials, they all say we were very caught off guard by how quickly countries like Iran and North Korea got to the place that they are now, which is, you know, in North Korea's case, stealing $81 million from the Bank of Bangladesh and pulling off the Sony Pictures attack. And in Iran's case, you know, bringing our banks to heel through the DDoS on their online banking sites and, you know, pulling off the Saudi Aramco and Sands attacks and locking up our hospitals and cities with ransomware. So, you know, they didn't have to get as good as we were. They just got good enough to be a very real threat. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that's kind of scary when you get back to sort of these geopolitical triggers is it was really frustrating for me, as I'm sure it was for you, maybe watching how cybersecurity policy broke down under the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. I mean, none of these deals were perfect. The Iran nuclear deal was not perfect. The agreement that Obama struck with Xi Jinping to cease intellectual property theft through cyber attacks was certainly not perfect either. But those deals really did handcuff those countries in terms of how they were using cyber to pursue their national goals. And as soon as Trump ripped up the nuclear deal, we saw Iran reemerge as one of the most prolific cyber armies in the world. And in China's case, we've seen them renew their intellectual property theft in a much more skilled and stealthy way. You know, they're not just doing the old misspelled spear phishing attacks of 10 years ago when I started on this beat. They're going after the internet service providers and the telecoms and picking, you know, big game targets.
Yeah, it's certainly, I think this is what it truly means is that I think under the Trump administration, geopolitics and traditional alliances seemed to sort of disintegrate along with mm-hmm. the actual new agreements. And what it caused was this, you know, this global uncertainty. And in that these governments acted offensively. And I think they definitely acted offensively in cyber. I think that's something people forget. It's like, it's not as if cyber is an extension of what's going on in the real world.
Right.
And then sometimes cyber makes things happen in the real world.
Right. And, you know, this idea of asymmetrical warfare is still very much alive. I mean, the other thing people forget is just organizationally, the United States and Five Eyes are at such a disadvantage because it's not like, you know, most of our attacks these days come from cyber command, from inside the Pentagon. We don't outsource these attacks to, you know, we don't pull the best security engineer at Google aside and say, tonight you have to hack this Chinese company and siphon back their intellectual property. We just don't do that. I mean, even if we got their IP, who would we give it to or how would we benefit from it? You know, we live in a free market society. Whereas these other countries, you know, have a very lively outsourcing trade. China's some of their most sophisticated IP theft hacks now come from contractors who work for the Ministry of State Security. And, you know, Russia has this sort of like Pax Mafiosa agreement with its own cyber criminals. And we've seen some of these Iranian private sector companies come out in these indictments as being behind these big hacks. And so it's really hard to establish cyber norms of behavior when, you know, if we agreed to, say, stop pursuing some of the offensive activity we have, and other countries signed on to that too, they just have so much more plausible deniability by outsourcing those same attacks to contractors or cyber criminals. And so just in terms of red tape, we're at a big disadvantage too, which I think is something to call out.
Right. I mean, there's also just such a natural two-facedness of being a so-called liberal democracy and having an intelligence agency that goes around the world and breaks the law. So I think like when you have that, you're facing that. And then you have other countries that even on the surface don't admit to play by those rules.
And I mean, it's so clear with the SolarWinds attack, you know, everyone's saying, oh, this is, you know, I forget who it was. I think it was Senator Durbin who called it, you know, likened it to an act of war. And it's like, well, it's not an act of war. It's a supply chain attack and it was very successful. And we do it all the time. You know, I reported that we did it to Huawei. And, you know, we used Microsoft's software to get into Iran systems. And so how do you respond to an attack that you're doing all day, every day too? It's just that for so long, we were so much better at it. And, you know, we still are in many regards, because you don't see us writing about NSA hacks all the time. And it's not because we're avoiding them. It's just that they're not as easily detected. So it's like, you know, the world has caught up to our capabilities. They're just not as good at hiding them. And how do you respond to an attack that you've been doing for a long time? You just kind of can't.
So you've been, so you wrote an entire book on the cyber weapons arms race, and it's very detailed and it's very, very intimately reported. My question is, you know, the US clearly won the conventional arms race against the Soviet Union and basically has probably won every conventional arms race since. Is it winning this current cyber weapons arms race? And do you see it continue to win if it is?
So I think it has won. You know, I think for a long time it spearheaded this market for cyber vulnerabilities and exploits. I think it has trained up some of the best cyber warriors in the world. And I think if you just look at Stuxnet, that attack was, you know, bar none, the most sophisticated attack the world, cyber attack the world has ever seen.
That time is here, because someone sabotaged a top-secret nuclear installation in Iran with nothing more than a long string of computer code.
But that was 10 years ago or more, and its lead is slipping because this gap is closing between what our adversaries are capable of and what we're capable of. And the problem is that it doesn't really matter if we're the most advanced cyber actor offensively on Earth when we're so woefully behind on defense. We're so frequently targeted, and in, you could argue we're more vulnerable than other countries because we're so wired, and we've just basically bought into this Silicon Valley promise of a frictionless society where we just want ease of access and convenience. And no one ever kind of stopped to think, should we be hooking up these systems? Like, should we be setting up this water treatment facility and establishing remote access for contractors who are sitting on the other side of the country? Like, is this a good idea? And unfortunately, inside government, or at least inside NSA, offense just totally eclipsed defense a long time ago. We came up with with this policy of active defense. We didn't actually come up with it. It was, you know, George Washington, I think, had the line that the best defense is a good offense. And we thought that that would work in cyber, but it just doesn't work. You know, every attack we've pulled off that's been detected has been a learning opportunity for our enemies, no more so than Stuxnet. I mean, that attack short term was brilliant, but long term, you know, the worm got out, people dissected it. Countries, even if they didn't have the capabilities, just saw the potential for espionage and for destruction. They saw what the US got away with code. And now there's, you know, arguably no country on Earth outside Antarctica that isn't at least looking at these possibilities. So, you know, we've opened this can of worms. And unfortunately, as we were pursuing these offensive programs, we never stopped to think about what would happen when the gap of capabilities closed.
And that's what I was going to say. It's important to note, I think, too, that the U.S. is probably the most hardwired country in the entire world. So, I mean, wouldn't you say inevitably that makes us the biggest target, and it makes us the most, I mean, obviously makes defense the most difficult?
Definitely. And, you know, I struggle with criticizing ourselves for it because, you know, it's we're just that virtualized. We made this decision. We wanted to be so connected. Defense is really hard. It comes down to, you know, everything from secure coding to the individual not clicking on these random links from strange email addresses. But, you know, at the end of the book, I looked around and I said, okay, you know, are there other comparable countries out there that are just as virtualized, digitized as us, who've been able to solve for this problem? And the answer is yes, actually. You know, Scandinavia, countries like Norway and Sweden are incredibly wired. You know, they have a huge, you know, a lot of technologies come out of Scandinavia.
I was going to say, Nicole, as a Canadian immigrant to the United States, one thing I do know and I totally recognize is that whenever you mention either a Scandinavian or Canadian government model for anything, Americans' eyes roll back into their skulls faster than like, it's just, well, thank you for coming on the show and congrats on the book. I mean, that's an accomplishment. It is difficult to, I mean, you took like 10 years to do it. So, I mean, congratulations.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, wait, I talked to you last week, right?
It's I all think so. Melding together. I don't know.
It's
what
all
is last
melding
week?
Together.
Anyway.
Yeah. I was like, was it Jason or you? No, I think it was. Oh, no, we didn't because it was your My First Hack
right.
episode.
Yes, correct.
So it was just all you. You were the show.
I was the show, yeah.
You were the show. And well done, you did.
Thank you.
Let's do this first story, because it's, I mean, one of the ones we consistently, I mean, this is like, it's like NSO, Ring, they just make a lot of appearances on the show, and Ring did it again. Some new emails show that Ring's private surveillance network is sometimes being used by cops, and the LAPD, to be exact.
Yeah, and in this particular case, it was used to try to identify people participating in protests, Black Lives Matter protests last summer, which is pretty creepy. You know, we knew that Ring partnered with police departments all across the country. As Edward notes in his story, the LAPD became the 240th public safety agency to sign a partnership with Ring. They claim that there's over 2,000 government agencies that have joined the program. So yeah, Ring is a good friend of the police. And in this case, the EFF obtained a bunch of emails showing that the company received a lot of requests for footage from essentially Los Angeles neighbors.
Which is a bit of a wild one. You know, it's like, how many more of these are out there?
Yeah, and, you know, I think that it's clear that the police has access to a lot of data for any kind of investigation. You know, they in the case of Black Lives Matter protests, they've also used traffic cameras and stuff like that. So, you know, police love to use surveillance cameras to spy on protesters. So I guess the question here is, do you want to be part of the surveillance apparatus by using a Ring camera? That is the question.
The whole idea of a Ring camera has completely, I don't know, it like freaks me out on many levels. It really does.
Yeah. I mean, as a consumer, I look at these things and I think like, is this actually giving me any security or is it just, or am I just volunteering to, you know, the panopticon?
Yeah. And in, you know, in some ways, security experts say like having a fake camera up can be deterrence, right?
Yeah.
Like without ever actually having a functioning camera. So it's like, I don't know, even the one when you have it, especially some people have these Ring cameras, it's like deep suburbs where, you know, this shit's not really happening. So it's like, well, what's the, like, I don't understand.
There's also very...
Why have it? It's just like, I feel like it's a very like an American obsession with security systems.
Yeah, and there's very little transparency. Ring says that these requests were legal because they were very specific. The EFF claims that they were not specific at all and they were just, you know, just a phishing operation to find out who was at this protest, which is very creepy.
Which is very creepy. And I also think like the other thing that no matter what your position is on police, you know, when you give police techniques and powers and technologies that they have at their fingertips, they're either going to ask for it and get it or subpoena you for it because whatever makes their investigation easier, they're likely to do, at least. And a lot of evidence suggests that's the behavior of most police forces in the past. Exactly. So you have them alone there. I mean, they're going to be something that they might tap into. Mm-hmm. All right. So this next one is, it's a spicy Lorenzo boy story. LastPass.
Yeah. LastPass, a very popular password manager. They claim to have 20 million users. So it's very famous. And I think it was one of the first ones to be free and very easy to use a while ago. So a lot of people use it and they made a lot of people angry today because today they announced that starting in a month, people that use their free tier will not be able to use it on both computers and mobile devices, which effectively makes, you know, the free app pretty useless. You know, I think it's fair to say because you could only use it, you know, until now you could use it on both computers and mobile devices. You could sync your passwords across their devices. And now you'll have to choose between computers and, you know, a computer and your phone, which is kind of a weird choice because these days we all use both.
Yeah, I just don't, like, I'm failing to understand why they're doing this.
Yeah, like, there's no technical reason to do this. What they told me is that they're just adjusting their offerings based on the market, which sounds a lot like we want people to pay for our app, which, you know, to a certain extent, it's fair. There are other password managers who are not free, which are not free that you have to pay for it. So maybe just go and say that. But yeah, it just seems like they're making the free app like, useless to force people to upgrade.
Right. Okay. Well,
the result is that a lot of people are upgrading to different apps. So I don't I think it's
yeah, I mean, like, work. I'll just go somewhere else, bruh. I don't know. I'm seeing a lot of outrage on this one online. I'm like, you know, a lot of cybersecurity folks.
Yeah.
Follow us and we follow them. And I'm seeing a lot of people being like, this is stupid.
Yeah. A lot of people are angry.
And these types of folks are generally pretty spiteful. They're pretty quick to act. That's one thing I could say about the cyber crew. They can throw the gauntlet down the minute they decide something in your technology isn't for them.
I think a lot of users in general are like that too, though. You know, like, we don't like our providers to change stuff without asking for our permission. And, you know, this feels like it came out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. it also doesn't seem like there's a good reason for it. So, you know, I understand why people are mad about it, because, you know, this app worked very well for them. And now there's an arbitrary change that kind of doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And I mean, but also I just think that the cyber crew, like people that work in cybersecurity, they put up with this kind of shit way less. And like if they're mm-hmm. sort of the canary in the coal mine on something, then probably can see that users aren't going to like it either. Other users.
Yeah. A lot of experts have come out saying that they will stop recommending LastPass from now on. So.
Mm-hmm. Even J-Bone said that. He's like, no, I'm done with LastPass. I won't recommend it to my friends and family anymore. I was like, oof.
Yeah, I mean, I've as a security reporter, a lot of people ask me what do I think about password managers and stuff, which one I recommend. And LastPass was an easy one to recommend because it's free, it works across all devices, and now that's not true anymore. And I think that's kind of a killer. You know, it kills the app. It's not going to be as easy to use for non-technical users.
Well, good story for the industry, good story for everyone to understand. So thank you, Lorenzo. And now we're moving on to the appearance, not quite my favorite topic of all time, but pretty much close to it, so we can probably cue the music.
Yeah, this is a great story from Becky. She interviewed Amir Siraj, a student at Harvard University, who has written a lot of papers about a theory called panspermia, which is a theory according to which life on Earth came from somewhere else, in this case, from Mars. So according to him, there is a possibility that some microbes essentially moved from Mars to Earth, perhaps on a meteorite or an asteroid. And that's how life on Earth started, which is pretty crazy because, you know, we always, especially in sci-fi, we always dream about starting life on Mars. You know, I never thought about the opposite.
Well, to be fair, I think like this type of thing has like made an appearance in, you know, like Discovery Channel, History Channel shows about conspiracy theories and aliens and like ancient Egyptians. I remember seeing one when I was a kid that was like, that weird descendants of Martian humans that came to Earth. Now, obviously, like, I think this is not the same thing, but one thing that is definitely true that I didn't know up until a few years ago was that Earth and Mars share like an inordinate amount of space garbage with one another and rocks. So it's like, you know, I guess like, I mean, obviously this dude is like very smart. So, I mean, there might be some real, you know, legs to this.
Yeah, it looks like there is science behind these theories.
Yeah, exactly. Like real science, not just illustrations.
And yeah, it could explain why, you know, as a race, we're kind of garbage. So it would make sense if we came from garbage from Mars.
Well, okay. But here's something that I wanted to ask you. Like, do you remember like the mid-90s to late 90s to like early 2000s obsession of sci-fi and like, you know,
oh, yeah.
ancient Egyptians and like aliens.
Oh yeah.
It's like, remember that? Like it was, they were really that whatever boomer screenwriting generation that was into that, like they really clung on to that. Like that, you know, like Stargate, for example.
Yeah. Stargate, Independence Day, X-Files, you know, the 90s were really sort of the golden years of UFO sci-fi.
Yeah. And then, but also in like Egyptians. Like ancient Egypt.
Yeah.
Or like Anubis, you know, like
yeah.
Suddenly it's like,
yeah, the pyramid, you know what I mean? Like, you know, the question was, how did the Egyptians build the pyramids? Of course.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's the aliens. Like, but yeah, it was a very popular theory. And, you know, it's interesting to see that there's actually some science behind it.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see how it comes through. I mean, that'd be pretty cool. I always love these types of stories. Becky does amazing work. She always has like just the most, you know, brainworm stories that kind of blow your mind a little bit. And this is definitely one of them.
Yeah, definitely check out Becky's work and watch her interview with Amir Siraj.
Definitely. Well, Lorenzo, we're recording this right now, you know, only moments away from your Barcelona playing Paris Saint-Germain. So good luck. I hope they lose. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.